Our scripture for today is from Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 20, and I'm reading from The Voice. Jesus and his disciples traveled across the sea to the land of Gerasa in Galilee. When Jesus came ashore there, he was immediately met by a man who was tortured by an evil spirit. The man lived in the cemeteries, and no one could control him, not even those who tried to tie him up or chain him. He had often been bound in chains, but his strength was so great that he could break the chains and tear the irons loose from his feet and from his hands. No one and nothing could subdue him. Day and night he lurked among the tombs or ran mad in the hills, and the darkness made him scream or cut himself with sharp-edged stones. When this man saw Jesus coming in the distance, he ran to him and fell at his knees in front of him, and Jesus commanded, "Come out of that man, you wicked spirit." But the evil spirit shouted, "What's this all about, Jesus, Son of the Most High? In the name of God, I beg you, don't torture me." "What is your name?" Jesus asked. "My name is Legion, for there are thousands of us in this body." And then Legion begged Jesus again to leave them alone, not to send them out of the country. There happened to be a large herd of swine, some 2,000 of them, feeding on the hill nearby. The spirit begged Jesus, "Send us into those pigs if you have to, so that we may enter into them." Jesus granted the request. The darkness swept out of the man and into the herd of pigs. And then the pigs thundered down the hill and into the water. And there they drowned, all 2,000 of them. The swineherds ran away, telling everybody they met what had happened. Eventually, a crowd of people came to see for themselves. When they reached Jesus, they found the man Legion had afflicted sitting quietly, sane, fully clothed. And when they saw this, they were overwhelmed with fear and wonder. Those who had witnessed everything told the others what had happened, how Jesus had healed the man, how the pigs had rushed into the sea, and how the pigs had destroyed themselves. When they had heard the whole story, the Gerasenes turned to Jesus and begged him to go away. When Jesus climbed back into the boat, the cured demoniac asked if he could come and be with him. But Jesus said no. Jesus said to him, "Stay here. I want you to go back home to your own people and let them see what the Lord has done, how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began telling this news in the 10 cities region. Wherever he went, people were absolutely amazed by what he told them.
Well, Well, more of you came in since the last time I was here looking at you. How are you? Think you're going to blow away this afternoon, this evening? Somebody said to me last night at the chili cook-off that I'll be lucky if I don't look out in my driveway and see my little blue car on its roof spinning around. That car takes a lot of flack. It just does. I want to teach the story of Mark 5, and after I've taught it and explained things to you to help you understand Jesus a little better, I want to give you three takeaways that I think will help you and me in our life. Before I do deal with this powerful story, I just want to go for a minute into what happens right before it, because there's a lot of parallels. I want to take us to Mark 4, 35 to 41. You don't necessarily have to turn. Just know that I'm just in the sentences before Mark 5. And what goes on is Jesus is back in Capernaum. Seems like my last couple of sermons, that's where he's been, where Peter had a house and Jesus made a home. I have a friend who's in the Holy Land right now. And she visited Capernaum. She's been posting stuff on the website, on Facebook. And she visited Capernaum, nothing but ruins. And she was at a ruin, just the foundation that allegedly is Peter's house. I don't know if it is or if it isn't. But what she said was that Capernaum's a lot smaller town than she imagined it would be. So that helped me, because I always kind of thought Capernaum was big, and evidently it's not. But he was there, and when he was done teaching, Jesus asked in Mark 4 if they would take him by boat over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, on the other side of the Sea of Galilee is the town Gerasa, which is where the Gerasenes were, which are Gentiles. And so Jesus wanted to go to the Gentiles. This makes this the first mission trip of the New Testament, okay, Mark 5. But anyway, they took him as he was, and while they were out, and it was night, a storm came up, a sudden violent storm that happens on the Sea of Galilee. Evidently, the waves broke over the bow. They were that high, and the boat began to take on water. We don't know a lot about Jesus personally, but we can infer some things. And one of the things that I infer in Mark 4 is Jesus was a sound sleeper. Because while the disciples were bailing water and bawling about their problem, Jesus was sound asleep in the stern. The commotion didn't wake him up, and they did. And they said, "Master, don't you care that we're drowning? Isn't it true that when we're in the midst of a crisis that threatens to take us under, after we pray to God for help, we always ask the question, not always, we often ask the question, does God really care? Master, don't you care that we're drowning?" And Mark says Jesus got up and rebuked the wind and the waves. It means talk to them sternly. If you read it in the New International Version, Jesus says something very pastoral, like, "Peace, be still." That's nice, but I don't, and that's what I named my title of my sermon. But you know what Jesus really said in the Greek as a translation? Muzzle it. That's true. That is absolutely true. I'm not making that up. He said, muzzle it to the wind and the waves, just like a dog. And one thing I know about muzzling a dog, because Kathy had one years ago before we were married, and you had to muzzle it, and it can whimper, it can whine, and it can woof, but it can't bite and it can't bark. And so when he commanded the wind and the waves to muzzle it, everything on that water went shh. And the disciples, who had been afraid for their lives, were now afraid of the outcome. They were filled with, in Greek, phobia, phobos, fear. And they said, "Who is this that even the wind and the waves are subject to him? Who is this?" Jesus said, "Why are you afraid? Where is your faith?" I like that. It reminded me of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They tell me he was deathly afraid of flying. And he took more than a little teasing about that, him being a minister and a man of the cloth. He was afraid to get in an airplane. Somebody asked him one time, "Where's your faith, brother?" And he said, "I have plenty of faith in God. I just have more experience with him on the ground." I like that answer, don't we all? Whenever Jesus took the disciples sailing, they had their experience with him back on dry land. And so I want to tell you, by the time now I'm at Mark 5, they got on the shore again. Their chains were rattled. And who would greet them as soon as they get their land legs but somebody who had had a history of rattling chains? And now I want to reread some of what Kathy did and teach it to you a little bit. When Jesus came ashore, he was immediately met by a man who was tortured. The word is tormented by an evil spirit. The New International Version says an unclean spirit. I looked it up. It means a spirit that was tainted by sin or foul. I like the word foul. The man had a foul spirit. And Mark says he lived in the cemeteries. Some of your translations say he lived among the tombs. In Gerasa, about a mile away from Gerasa, is a cliff. And that cliff has caves, outcroppings of rock and make caves. And those caves were naturally used as graves for the dead. And I'm assuming, like was done at that time, the bodies would decompose and the bones would be there. And then they'd come back for the bones and they'd put them in a box or an ossuary. But anyway, there were dead people there. And it was not uncommon for squatters to live in those tombs with the dead people, because it was better to be among the dead than to be homeless. So what Mark is telling me is this guy with the tainted spirit literally lived in the tombs. Why? Well, he lived there because nobody could control him. Though they tried to tie him up, to bind him, get the impression of a guy that's incarcerated. They tried to tie him up, but listen to it. He had often been bound in chains, but his strength was so great, he broke the chains and tore irons from his feet and hands. Nobody could subdue him. The word is tame, like an animal. Nobody could tame him. He was out of control. Mark wants you to think of King Kong or the Incredible Hulk, really. Day and night, he lurked among the tombs, and he ran mad in the hills, and darkness made him scream. The word is crazo, from which I'm assuming we get our English word crazy. He screamed, it means he shrieked in sounds that you could not understand. And he cut himself, actually he disfigured himself with the sharp edges of stones. He was a cutter, folks. Took me about 20 years to read this text before I understood that he was a cutter. Do you know anybody who's a cutter? Somebody who cuts themselves to relieve their pain. They have such emotional pain that the cutting actually on their arm, on their legs, on their stomach actually relieves that. There's a woman, her name is Karen Contario. She's the author of the book Bodily Harm, and she says, I can go to any school in America and everybody knows at least one person who cuts. Right? You're shaking your head, Andrea. You kind of know. And she said that it's a common occurrence between 14 and 17-year-olds. And I don't know about your experience, but she says you can see it as low as 10 and 11-year-olds. Right? This man was a cutter, but he cut himself to the point of mangling himself, disfiguring himself, rubbing himself to get out the stress on the rocks. It was a form of what the Catholics call mortification or penance. Now, Mark wants us to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this man was controlled by this evil spirit, was possessed, not because he's a cutter. Let's get that very clear. Because he was so extreme, he disfigured himself. Because he was so out of control. Because he screamed in unintelligible words. Because he was so powerful, it was different than you. I've seen the weights that you lift up on Facebook. I mean, I've seen the weights. And I'm looking at Ben Stevenson, I'm saying, there is one strong dude, you know. And he doesn't even grunt and groan when he picks that stuff up. This guy's stronger than you are. He is superhuman. You know, you don't have to be, let me say this. Demonic possession, by definition, I read this, destroys the likeness of God or the divine in us. So that who God created us to be is not recognizable anymore. Who God created him to be is not recognizable anymore. And I want to tell you, you don't have to be in the ministry very long to look evil in the face. And the disciples were finding that out. I told you earlier that they had their chains rattled. Now, that was because of the storm. They had their chains rattled because of the storm. They had their chains rattled because Jesus commanded the wind and the waves. And then they came to Gerasa, and they're rubbing shoulders with Gentiles. And they're rubbing elbows with pigs. Two things that the Jews found extremely offensive. And to top it all off, now you've got this crazed man with superhuman strength living in a place that's only assigned to the dead. Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. And that's when the demon shouted at the top of his voice. And I looked that up in the Greek, and it means he gave a terrible utterance. I got to take a drink of water because I've been practicing this. I'm channeling Lord of the Rings here. And he said, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" That's pretty good, don't you think? That's pretty good. Precious. Yeah, precious. Oh, precious. The demon knew who Jesus was, which was the thing that the disciples didn't know. I'm coming back to chapter 4 and about, who is this? That even the winds and the waves are subject to him, and the demon knew who he was. But the question, what do you have to do with us? The question really translated is, what do we have in common, Jesus? What do we have in common? What do Satan and Jesus have in common? The answer is absolutely nothing. And we talked about that last week, except one thing. They both believe in God. Did you ever think about that? And here this demon is appealing to the mercy of God not to throw him out of the territory. It's ironic. And yet James told his church, you believe in God, good for you. Even the demons do that. And they shudder. I think James was probably thinking of this story. But the demon begged Jesus repeatedly not to send him out of the area, not to uproot him. So Jesus said, what's your name? And he said, my name is Legion. A legion was the largest combat unit in the Roman army. 6,000 soldiers, fighting men. When he wrote, Mark isn't saying that this guy was possessed by 6,000. He uses the word legion for many. It was enough for 2,000 swine. Clearly, Jesus is outnumbered. Now, I'm going to give you something, brethren, to take home with you. What's Jesus going to do? He's outnumbered. Now, this is a point in the story where you think Jesus would stand up with his authority and power and command this demon, these demons, to leave. He doesn't. You'd think that this is a time when Jesus would engage in cosmic combat like the book of Revelation to show his glory. He doesn't. What Jesus does is he yields to the demon's wishes and allows the demons to leave the man and go into the swine that are dwelling there on the hills feeding. He gives the demon exactly what he wants. Now, this is good and evil. And he gives the demon exactly what he wants. Brethren, this is a classic example of peace and strength through non-resistance. It just is. You see? And when Jesus does this, the legion took possession of the pigs, and immediately the pigs rushed headlong, went down an embankment, went into the sea. And they were drowned. It's probably, for Joel, it's the most dramatic moment of the scriptures, of the New Testament, of the Gospels. It's a dramatic moment. It puts the sea that I told you about, in it puts that whole storm on the sea to shame. It does. And it begs the question, who is this that even the demons are subject to him? You know, and I know, and there's a book that tells me pigs can't fly. So it doesn't wonder me that they fell off the cliff, but this is what. Did you know a pig can swim? Any pig farmers here? Yeah? Did you know pigs can swim, Raymond? Yeah, they can. They can swim. So the question is, how did all 2,000 of them drown? I could see 50 of them. I could see 100 of them, 2,000 of them. Mark is telling you that this is a supernatural, this is a spiritual occurrence. And when it happened and the demons were drowned and they were gone, this man that was out of control, cutting himself to shreds, screaming at the top of his lungs, this man sat beside Jesus, Mark says, clothed and in his right mind. I looked that up. It means he had perfect balance. Emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually, he was balanced. Don't you wish? He had peace at last. It's like everything that raged inside of him. And you ever had a war inside of you? And I know you have. It's just like, pshh. Now, the reaction to this dramatic turn of events is the exact same reaction as the disciples had when they were on the boat with the storm. And that is, they had fear, phobos, and a lack of faith. Jesus said, "Where is your faith?" The farmers all came to Jesus, and the townspeople all came to Jesus, and they begged him to get out. They were afraid he'd do something else. What else would he do? And dealing with the monster, it's like it's the old saying, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. They were more comfortable with what they knew than what they didn't know. So here we go. What's the moral of the story? And what can we take away? Say, well, this is nice, Joel, and I appreciate it, but it doesn't have anything to do with me. Well, does it? Number one takeaway I would want to take away if I were you is this. There isn't a person here sitting that doesn't want peace in their life. Everybody wants peace. And that's because we live in a culture where there's a lot of stress. And I don't care if you're a teacher or a farmer, if you're retired, if you're working. I don't care what kind of relationship you're in. The fact of the matter is you have stress. And you want the peace of God that passes all understanding. The trick is, in order to have that peace, you're going to have to undergo transformation. And a word that you and I don't like, change. In order to have perfect balance in his crisis, the demoniac had to be radically transformed by the shining scalpel of the Holy Spirit. Most of us on our very best day approach change like the guy who says he swims in the ocean and really just gets his big toe wet. John Maxwell said, and I'm quoting here, it's usually customary to perceive change as a simple refinement to the way we've always been doing it. Change is just a refinement to the way. Like, for example, I thought, what does that mean? If I'm going to preach it, what does it mean? Well, it means this. Kathy and I have an artificial tree, and some of you have artificial Christmas trees. So every December, every Thanksgiving, you name it, you go down in your basement, you go in your attic, you pull out the big long box that you can hardly pack the year before. You pull that tree out of there, you fool with assembling it and fluffing it up and getting it there. You stick it in the same corner, put the same apron around it, put the same decorations on it, put the same star on it, except this year you're going to have white lights instead of colored. And you say, man, did we ever change things up? No, you didn't. You simply had a simple refinement of what you've always done. Maxwell says, rather, change is something altogether different, which, of course, it needs to be. I read a Facebook post yesterday from somebody you don't know. They're up north in Martinsburg. She's about a 27-year-old woman, I'm guessing. And she graduated in her master's degree. And she's had something secret in her life for a long time. And yesterday on Facebook, she came out. And what she did was she admitted to everybody, church people and everybody, that she had had a problem with alcohol and cigarettes. And she said, I'm here today. I'm 16 months sober and 12 months without a smoke. And I was so proud of her, and I wrote her on Facebook and said, you know, I was proud of her. But she had a lot of peace and joy about that moment. But can I tell you something? Her name is Sam. Sam made some radical changes in her life. Changes of friends, changes of habits, changes of where she was. In order for that to occur. Many of us resist change because change takes us into the unknown. You know that. I know that. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But the sad thing is, many of us crave peace in our lives and freedom from our chains. The old and familiar are so comfortable, we just stay the way we are. That's why the farmers, I mean, it was an economic thing. Just imagine if 2,000 cows in this county disappear and drown. Farmers are going to be worried. They were so comfortable with their livelihood, so comfortable with their economy, so comfortable with the guy in the tombs. It was their normal. Whereas the peace of God that passes all understanding, listen to me, brings a new normal, which few of us want to embrace. And so consequently, it eludes us. I had a counselor years ago who said to me, the key to your chains is in your own pocket. If you think about it, that's true. I'm talking about change. What he meant was having Jesus take possession of our lives, asking him into our heart, will bring balance to our situation. But then we have to let him there and want him to be there, unlike the town folks and even the disciples who didn't know what to do with him, and make the change that he recommends. That's all I want to say about that. I could say a lot more, but you get the idea. Change is the key. A second takeaway that I would take if I were you is having God's peace in our chaos requires a transition from fear to faith. I want to tell you a story, and this is going to mean something to you because you know who it is. A young woman that usually sits there in that wheelchair, Amber, is 32 years old. Now, she'll hear this online this week, or her mother will. So, Leah, I'm telling this for you. But she's 32 years old. I knew Amber from the time she was 4. As you know, Amber was born with an inoperable brain tumor. And the goal was to keep it from growing. That was always the goal, that she could live as long as she could. But the family found a surgeon who was willing to take her on and try to get it out of her head, and so they traveled to Manhattan to New York University Hospital, where Amber underwent about a 6-hour surgery to remove that tumor. I was there, and the surgeon came to check on her and see if she was ready to have the surgery. And instead of taking her, he took her to the OR himself. And instead of taking her on a gurney or on a wheelchair, they walked. I can still see it. She and the surgeon, hand in hand, she carrying a pink doll, which she still has. While the parents and I sat in the doorway and kind of went like this and held back the tears. Because that surgery was high risk. There was no guarantee she was coming back. Or there was no guarantee she wouldn't have a stroke or she wouldn't be disfigured, okay? That was high risk. She walked to the OR. Later that afternoon, my friend Sam, who went with me, wanted to go to the Empire State Building to the top on the observation deck, wanted me to go along. I was terrified of height. Terrified of height. We stood in line to get, and I was kind of hoping we wouldn't have the time, and we stood in line, and I just had every excuse in the book why I couldn't go up to that observation deck. And finally, I thought, weren't you just with Amber? Didn't you see her walk to the OR not knowing if she was going to live or die? And the worst thing that could happen to me is get stuck in the elevator. I went, and she came out okay. But my point is, and the takeaway is, sometimes in order to do something, you have to do it scared. And when you do, you find faith. But you have to do it scared. That's the second takeaway. Replacing fear with faith. And the third one, and the last one is, when the man of the tombs changed and found his faith, he begged Jesus to let him go back with him to Capernaum. And who wouldn't want to go? Who wouldn't want to go with Jesus? And Jesus told him, verse 9, no, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. I had a teacher, the Gospel of Mark. Go home to your family and tell them what God has done for you. And she said, that's the hardest commandment in the Gospels. Why? We just talked about this downstairs in Sunday school, and I had a wonderful testimony from Dorothy Blau, who agrees that's the hardest commandment of the Gospels. Because what essentially Jesus was doing is saying, go back to the ones who knew you the way you were and treated you badly because of it. Go back to the ones who knew you as you were and treat you badly because of it. See, Jesus had gone to Gerasa as a missionary to minister to the Gentiles and the unbelievers. They rejected him, but he wasn't without resource. He said to the man, look, you got a story. You go tell your story to those who need to hear it. You go tell your story to those who will listen. You go tell your story to those who liked you better when you were a hellraiser. You go tell your story and you tell them what the Lord has done for you. And that, my friends, is what he's asking you to do. That's the third takeaway. Change and faith always have a story that needs telling. Change and faith always have a story that needs telling. How about you? You have a story that needs telling? Are you at peace with it? If not, why aren't you? And what are you going to do about it? Jesus, I thank you for speaking to us through this ancient text. I love this text. Your word in Mark 5 is just one right after the other, three stories, bang, 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 and they're all very dramatic. But showing us your significance and your power and also your presence and what it can do. Sometimes you ask us to do the courageous things when we'd rather do the safe one. Sometimes we have to. Life puts us in a position where there is no choice but to do it scared. And we wonder, you know, do you care? But you do. You're just asking us to take your hand and go. And you'll meet us and be with us on the other side or even during the process. Sometimes there are things that you want to see changed in our life, and change would do us good, but instead of having the courage to do that, we kind of groan in inutterable sounds and hang on to the very thing that means us no good. Jesus, forgive us for that. And help us to let you be the dominant force and the dominant factor in our lives. And together, and with this Holy Spirit's prodding, we can find that blessed peace of God that passes all understanding, and that's what we crave. Help us to have peace and help us to be peacemakers. I pray it in your name. Amen.